Representative Fabian, I'm going to have you go ahead and start. I'll wait to formally bring the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. We need just one more member. But Representative Fabian, we're going to continue with your presentation on House Files 616 and 617. Representative Fabian, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's good to be back again, members. Mr. Chair, I would be, at this point, I think that I've, spoken to the bill a fair amount. So if we could just move the bills again.
Representative Fabian, I just need one more person to get the bill actually before us. Why don't we bring the agency down here? I believe that that's where we left off. The agency has not had a chance to comment. So, Commissioner Fluff, I'm sorry. Oh, no, I'm wrong, Commissioner. Sorry. I'm being corrected by the ABLE staff here. I've got a list of testifiers. I believe Mr. Freeman from PFA. I thought I saw him here. Yes, here he is. If you want to come forward, I've got you first on the list. And then next is Mr. Lewis with the Red River Basin Commission.
Good morning.
And then, members, I would like, 1 second, Mr. Freeman. Members, I'd like to bring the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Representative Uglum, the minutes of February 26th need to be moved. Representative Uglum.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move those great minutes.
Discussion to the minutes of the 26th, February 26th. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Representative Fabian, if you want to move your bills for possible inclusion, that would be great. Go ahead. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 616 and 617. At this time.
For possible inclusion,
yes.
In an omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Fabian. Mr. Freeman, if you want to begin your testimony, please identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority, or the state agency that provides financing for local government infrastructure projects, primarily wastewater and drinking water projects. I believe you have in your handout, in your packets, a two-page handout with our little PFA pipe logo at the top. I'm going to give just a kind of brief overview of our clean water programs and talk a little bit about the details of the funding that's specific to the kinds of treatment plant upgrade projects that are before you in the bills today. The PFA, we have two what we consider our base programs, and the largest is the Clean Water Revolving Fund, which is a low-interest loan program for wastewater and stormwater projects. That program provides funding for a whole variety of eligible projects that are construction, rehabilitation, expansion, upgrade of all municipal wastewater facilities and the various components. We also have a WIF, Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Grant Program that provides supplemental grants based on per household affordability criteria. Those grants are used either to combine with our Clean Water Revolving Fund loans, or we also can use those to match funding with USDA Rural Development, which is the federal agency that also provides funding for water and wastewater infrastructure. And then we have two programs that are funded under the dedicated Clean Water Legacy Funds, and most relevant to the discussion today is the Point Source Implementation Grant Program. That program provides 50% grants to cities to upgrade their treatment systems to meet more stringent effluent limits and it's actually a hybrid program that was originally the predecessors to this were created in the 2005-2006, there was a TMDL grant program and a phosphorus reduction grant program. both of which were to help cities meet more stringent standards. TMDL is total maximum daily load studies that Pollution Control Agency does to look at what needs to be done to fix an impaired water. When that then leads to more stringent wastewater standards for a treatment plant, this program, the TMDL program, was able to provide a 50% grant. There's also other, there was concern about phosphorus requirements in general, and so a separate program for phosphorus reduction was created. And then those two programs were merged in 2013 because there was so much overlap between the two, they were merged into one.
Yeah.
The little box or the table at the bottom of the first page indicates the funding for those programs and the awards from the beginning. A couple of points to point out there, because of that overlap and the kind of duplicative funding between the two programs, and the compared to the pace of the projects, which were slower than was expected, so we had the funding was coming in faster than the projects. The needs are certainly out there and continue to be out there, but that's why you'll see under 2015 there's a $12.6 million cancellation of funds those were funds that were left in that phosphorus reduction grant program and were not needed to meet the projected needs. On the second page, you can see the list of current applications that we have for this program. We take applications once a year in July and award projects or award grants as projects are ready to proceed with construction. The projects with the shaded rows have been funded to date since July 1st, and then the others are in various stages of getting their final designs approved and going to bid. Those projects that aren't able to go ahead this year will just carry over, refresh their applications for next year. And it's typical that we have a lot more applicants than we have projects ready to go because there is a long lead-in time. These are complicated projects. The engineering design and the things associated with that take quite a bit of time. The last two pages or one sheet of your packet shows all of the projects we funded under these combined point source implementation grants, TMDL grants, phosphorus grants, the combined impact of those programs and the projects that we funded. You can see there's a variety of things. A lot of this is related to phosphorus, there's as well as other TMDL requirements, as well as some other parameters as well, where cities are required to meet some more stringent limits. You can see there's a column kind of right in the middle of the page that says project cost to meet required standard. That's the eligible cost for the 50% grant. In some cases, the grant may be less for a variety of reasons, but in general, that's the cost that's eligible for a 50% grant. And then there's a column just to the right of that that says total cost, including rehab and expansion. That indicates a lot of times cities want to combine this project to provide more phosphorus treatment with some other rehab expansion improvements to their treatment plant, and so they'll do them as a combined project. It's more cost effective, more efficient to do it that way, and so that's what that column indicates is other costs that were done, other improvements to the treatment plant that were done at the same time. And then the funding to the right shows other funding that was combined. A lot of it was our own Clean Water Revolving Fund loans, the WIF grants that I mentioned, as well as some other funding, primarily the USDA Rural Development.
Thank you. Mr. Freeman, anything else you want to add?
That's a quick overview. I'd be
Thank
happy
you.
To take any
Appreciate
questions.
It. Any questions? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Freeman, are any of these funds used for the operating costs once these systems are put in place?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, no. All of these costs are strictly for capital improvements. The operating costs are paid for by local governments.
Follow up. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, when you design these systems, or when the systems are designed, are the operating costs included as, you know, part of the design parameters? Do they? I mean, certainly there's more than one way to build these systems, and some are more expensive to operate than others. Is that a consideration as you evaluate these systems?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, certainly that is true. Each city will hire a consulting engineer to look at what is the requirement that they have to meet, what other rehabilitation of old facilities, what things do they have to do, and the engineer will look at a variety of different alternatives. And that essentially do a cost-effective analysis there, and that does include the long-term operating costs as well as the upfront capital costs.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Much of the funds are revolving loan funds. You know, if we look at your grand total there, you got $317 million in loan funds and $34 million, $35 million rounded in grant funds. What are the terms for these communities that are getting a loan?
Director Freeman.
The Clean Water Revolving Fund loans, the interest rates are set based on a discount from the essentially AAA market rate at the time we make the loan. So the interest rates have varied over the years, but in recent years with market rates so low, our loans have been pretty much at our minimum 1% for the last year or two.
Director Freeman, what about default rate? How often do they default?
Mr. Chair, we have zero defaults on these loans.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are any of these projects involved with any nutrient trading procedures where if a community puts in a system, it saves other communities from having to put in a system as soon?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, none of these have been specific nutrient trading projects, although that could be an eligible project if it was brought forward. We haven't seen any applications. There have been projects where a city, oftentimes a smaller city, makes a determination that it's more cost-effective to connect to a nearby city for treatment than to add the phosphorus treatment to their own system, and so there have been a couple of cases where that's happened.
Last follow-up question, Representative Torres.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for the long
You're
questioning.
All right.
The defaults, I think we should just talk about those a little bit. You know, we understand that it takes a lot of time for these permits to get in place before these projects can be funded. Can you just briefly tell us, explain a little more about why these defaults occurred? Was it over missight on applicants' part? Was it lengthy permit applications? Did we put too much money in the fund? What's your perspective on that?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Parkinson, if I understand the question, it's related to the funding versus the pace of projects that have gone to construction. And I think really what it comes down to is when the PCA just determines a new standard is necessary for a city and it's written into the city's permit, cities have a period of time, I believe it's potentially as up to 10 years, to actually make the capital improvements that will allow it to meet that new standard. And so while there are clearly a number of cities that over time will have to make these improvements and upgrades, the pace of the actual projects going to construction has turned out to be really slower than I think was originally envisioned when these programs were created.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Freeman, we had heard last week from the cities of Breckenridge and I believe Moorhead. Did they apply for funding in this program?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they have not to this point, but they would be eligible to meet those limits. And we do take applications every year. And I should mention we have funded all eligible projects when they are ready to go to construction. You're probably familiar, we have a priority list, and the loan program and the WIF grants are dependent on the priority list. But for these point source implementation grants and the predecessor programs, we've been able, the funding has been sufficient to fund every project that's been applied and been ready to go to construction.
Follow up.
Well, Mr. Chair, you completely anticipated my next question, which was to confirm what you said earlier. I believe that there was sufficient funding, that in fact you had more funds available than even applications or municipalities applying. Is that accurate, or did I hear that correctly?
Director Freeman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein. We have, because of the kind of the, as the programs were first created, the funding ramped up more quickly than the projects, and so we are this, the legacy funding bill for this session does have a cancellation of the $12.6 million, just because those are old funds, and we do also have a request for additional new funding going forward, and so we are trying to balance the funding with the projected projects, and we'll continue to do that, and we'll continue to request funds for to meet the needs that we see that are there, because we know there are, looking forward into the future, there are a number of projects, and you can see from that list of 2015 applicants, there are a lot of cities that are affected by this, and we want to make sure we've got funding available for them.
Representative Horns.
One quick last follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So even with this cancellation of the $12 million, you have sufficient funding, you believe?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was for Ms. Taylor and Mr. Hagemeyer on turnbacks, because I know with other funds we have like a four-year or a six-year to get a restoration project. So the ones that are being turned back, are those from the 2009, 2010, or are they more what's the period for, or Mr. Freeman, if you know the answer to that, what's the turn back time? How much time are the cities allowed to use the grants that they have applied for?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the funding, and I should have mentioned the first couple of years the funding for these programs was actually bond funds, and those have a five-year life, and the appropriations from the Clean Water Legacy Funds have a five-year period too, because of the fact that we understand it takes time to get these projects designed and ready for construction. So there is that five-year window. The very first year of legacy appropriations actually had a available until spent language, and so part of the cancellation are those old available until spent funds. And part are from 2011 appropriation that had a five-year term on it.
Mr. Freeman, were they 2011, or were they 2009 and 2010, or you think some were even 2011?
Well, I think they were, Mr. Chair, appropriated in 2009 for fiscal 10 and 11.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, follow up.
And maybe, Mr. Chair, the best way is to get a chronology of time of both bond funds and clean water, because if there were funds that were canceling now, is it a safe assumption to say there were funds that could cancel next year or the year after that have been appropriated that are not spent either?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's exactly what we will be monitoring. And the table on the first page shows that year-by-year appropriations and then the awards that have been made. But we will be monitoring the life of those funds and awarding as many projects as we can from them, and then it's possible there could be future cancellations, but we'll continue to request new funds as well because of that we know these needs are out there, and we continue to receive new applications each year.
Representative Hansen, I think we should have Director Freeman work with our staff, one, to get us which years did get turned back. I know we had that information already, but let's confirm that you're in agreement with our staff, what years they got turned back, what years they were for. And I think the most important point, a couple years that are close to getting ready to be turned back, is there potential more money coming back? And I guess to Representative Hansen's point, then, that is helpful for us going forward. Are we maybe overfunding this project, which we'd like to know if that is the case, if it's an ongoing. I thought I was told that this was not an ongoing situation, but it was more a bump in the radar. So, Representative Hansen, when we go to Representative Hansen first, then you, Director. Representative Hansen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, if he has an answer to that point, because mine is just on a slightly different piece.
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think it is a bump in the road, as you say, from those first early years of funding and the slower pace of projects. We'll continue to monitor that. We can only award the funds when there's eligible projects ready to go to construction. So we'll monitor that, but I don't expect a big cancellation in the future the way there was.
Well, if you could work with Mr. Hagemeyer, and we'd like that information sent to us. Last follow-up, Representative Hansen, then we're going to go to these other testifiers. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Freeman. I have a question on your column, total cost, including rehab and expansion. Is that a required cost, or are those discretionary costs that may be a choice by the local government to add in as long as they're beginning the project?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, those are costs that local governments are responsible for maintaining these wastewater facilities, expanding them, replacing worn-out components, and all of that is a local government responsibility. They can apply to our loan fund to help cover those costs. And so this is just simply kind of an illustration that often when a city is making the improvements to meet that more stringent phosphorus limit, they want to coordinate that with this other rehab project. It's just more cost effective from a construction management standpoint to do that.
Thank you. And I miss Representative Hauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Over the last few years, whenever we have inquired on behalf of a member why their city project wasn't funded, we were frequently told by Mr. Freeman that they haven't completed the paperwork. I mean, there is some obligation on the part of the local government. And one of the thoughts that occurs to me is the bigger the city, the more likely, you know, the more staff they have to accommodate that. The smaller the city, the more likely that's a bigger burden for them. And I've sometimes wondered about a resource office on behalf of those cities that would just help facilitate some of that. It's very often the local government that just hasn't quite closed the loop, as the reason we're given.
Comment on that, Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, that is very true. For small communities in particular, it's a lot to manage and a lot to deal with. We do work with various partners. My staff is quite small, and we're all here in St. Paul, but we do partner with many of these projects with USDA Rural Development. As I mentioned, they do have regional offices around the state and have expertise in specifically working with small rural communities. We also coordinate and I hope more so in the future with Minnesota Rural Water Association as a nonprofit association that has technical circuit rider technical experts that go around and work with a variety of small cities. So that is a concern, and we're looking at ways to try to help those small communities.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll hear from Jeff Lewis, Executive Director, Red River Basin Commission. Welcome back, Mr. Lewis. Good to see you in your new role. You could identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony. I understand all the rest of the testifiers have worked with Ms. Sipko on how long a testimony, because we do have, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of close to a half an hour from MPCA needed. And we do have two bills that will take a few minutes before we adjourn at 10 o'clock. Welcome, Mr. Lewis.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Lewis. I'm the Executive Director of the Red River Basin Commission. As Chairman McNamara indicated, I've been before this committee before in my previous life as a state manager for the Pollution Control Agency, and I retired from them about 2 years ago and went to work for the Red River Basin Commission. I'm here today to talk a little bit about our intent of trying to have a basin-wide approach to nutrient reduction strategies in the Red River Basin. Our organization has been trying to work collectively with North Dakota, Minnesota, and Manitoba to try and develop a voluntary nutrient reduction strategy. We're trying to avoid necessarily the approach of taking a formal TMDL, but encourage participation by all of the stakeholders involved. We've been working on this effort for about a two-year period now, and have trying to encourage within the Red Basin anyway the need of trying to focus on non-point pollution for phosphorus reduction. Our basin is highly agricultural in nature. About 80% of our phosphorus load to the Red River is coming from non-point. And we see the need of developing a nutrient reduction strategy that more addresses non-point activities if we really want to make a difference. I also sit on the executive committee for the Lake Winnipeg Initiative, similar to some of the concerns that I know you folks are well aware of with the Gulf of Mexico and the nitrogen inputs there. We've been working with Lake Winnipeg. Their main issue is phosphorus inputs into that lake. The province of Manitoba will be asking for about a 50% reduction in phosphorus load coming down the Red River to try and save their lake from increased eutrophication that's currently occurring. So we've been working collectively with the groups. Our organization is made up of a 41-member board, the commissioners Stein from PCA, as well as Commissioner Landwehr and Executive Director John Jasky are all members of our board. So we work very closely with the state organizations as well as the county watershed district and locals, and have been trying to focus on the need of doing non-point nutrient reduction within our basin. I could go on for a long time for those of you that know me, but I promised the committee administrator that I wouldn't. So I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Did you have a little more to add? Or Representative Fabian, did you have a point to make? Or are you ready for questions?
Ready for questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Canada may force us to do the right thing. Is that what I hear you saying? That's not really a question.
A comment.
Help me with this, because a voluntary approach, I'm just always struggling with those responsible people who do the right thing. They often bear the burden, but it's the irresponsible one that a voluntary effort kind of lets off the hook. Can you help me with that issue of responsible players versus those who?
Director Richard. You're executive director, it says here, so you may have had that title before, but I'm kind of a believer in following titles. So
I've been called a lot of things over my career.
Director Lewis, I'm sorry.
Chairman McNamara and Representative Hausman, we feel that this voluntary approach will work within the Red River Basin. Our organization put together what was called a long-term flood solutions similar effort to deal with flood damage reduction efforts within the basin. We established goals for flood protection for municipalities, as well as a 20% flow reduction goal to try and address the local and ag damages input. And we see a similar effort could be done with water quality. We've been fairly successful in the basin on getting the parties together to move forward and feel that a voluntary approach would work for water quality as well.
Follow up, Representative Hausman.
Well, so you don't see any bad actors? In other words, everybody does the right thing?
Director
in a voluntary
Lewis.
Circumstance?
I guess I try not to label people as bad actors and give them an opportunity to participate. With the representation that we have from citizens, local units of government from the municipalities, we have mayors from municipalities that sit on our board, all the way up through county commissioners, to state agency folks that sit on our board. I think we have the ability to have the conversations that need to be had to move things forward. I think we're a little bit unique in organizations within the state in our ability to do that. And you know, we were very successful in the flood on the long-term flood solutions work, and feel that a similar effort could be done on water quality.
Representative Hausman, additional follow-up?
Okay.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lewis, you had mentioned the Gulf of Mexico, and then you mentioned Lake Winnipeg. Is there a dead zone in Lake Winnipeg? Are we contributing to that?
Director Lewis.
Chairman McNamara and Representative Hornstein, there are two different issues. The Gulf of Mexico issue is from nitrogen and nitrates, and that's what's creating the dead zone there. They don't have that same issue with nitrogen in Lake Winnipeg. Their major pollutant of concern is phosphorus because of the algae and the toxic blue algae blooms that they've been experiencing lately on that lake. So it's kind of two different issues as far as what nutrient is causing that. But the watershed that feeds Lake Winnipeg, about 20% of it is represented by water that comes down the Red River. The amount of phosphorus that enters Lake Winnipeg, about 60% of it comes from the Red River. So it's by far the largest contributor when you look at the size versus the amount that's coming, and is part of the reason that we're being asked by Canada and Manitoba in particular to try and see what we can do.
Representative Fabian, where's the rest of the water to Lake Winnipeg come from?
I figured you were going to ask that,
yeah.
Mr. Chair.
You saw the question look on my face.
The Dills District.
I assume that's what it was, yeah. But I didn't know. Yeah. Representative Fabian, can you answer first my question, then you were ready to make a comment. Where does the water for Lake Winnipeg come from if only 20% comes from the Red River?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Lewis said...
Director Lewis.
I think he said 60%, but the rest...
Well, 60% no. of the phosphorus comes up the Red. Only about 20% of the watershed, the largest watershed to Lake Winnipeg is actually the Assiniboine River that goes across western Canada. There's also major inputs from Rainy Lake of the Woods watershed, as well as the Souris watershed.
Thank you. Representative Fabian, a comment, then we're back to Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my comment simply is this, and this is kind of what these bills are about. And everybody wants clean water. That's the premise, first of all. But when you take a look at the amount of water that's going into Lake Winnipeg, and I sit on the International Legislators Forum, I meet with the delegation from Manitoba, when you talk about the Assiniboine River, when you talk about the Rainy River watershed that comes from the Boundary Waters Canoe area through Lake of the Woods up there, the amount of water that's going into Lake Winnipeg from the Red River and the amount of phosphorus that's getting in there, and then the amount of phosphorus that's actually coming from the point source facilities along the Red River, you know, the point becomes, can we better spend this money someplace else? And that's kind of the whole nexus for what I'm trying to accomplish here. And I know that Mr. Lewis can really come up with some scientific things. The other thing, we're going to see a letter later today from Governor Dalrymple in North Dakota, talking about, you know, their efforts going forward. I do want to point out that the Basin Commission, Mr. Lewis's group, was the one that helped him put that together.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Well, no, thanks. Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I mean, that 60% figure of the phosphorus coming from the red is concerning. So I think that's the number we need to really look at.
Thank you. Representative, is there a comment on that? Director Lewis.
Thank you, Chair McNamara. The only comment that I really want to leave you with is, you know, for the Red River Basin, the vast majority of the phosphorus is coming from non-point sources. We would really like to focus a lot of effort on trying to reduce those non-point sources. Is it critical for some of the point sources to work as well? I really didn't want to get into that debate because a lot of my old colleagues are sitting up in the audience as well, but the vast majority of the phosphorus is coming from non-point, and we need to look at addressing that issue.
Thank you. To that point, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's the, you know, when Representative Hausman was speaking about the flood money, you know, we've spent hundreds of millions of dollars on flood damage mitigation, and the requests keep coming, and kind of reaching for my wallet here to cover it because I sense hundreds of millions of dollars coming in requests to deal with non-point. And the challenge is that we have a treaty with Canada, a 1909 treaty, that we have to do things. Both sides of the border between the United States and Canada have to deal with water quality. So that's concerning, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, I have four other folks that have questions. Purcell, Hancock, Johnson, Clark. That's Representative Johnson, Representative Clark. And then we are going to wrap this up, and then we are going to take testimony from the other four folks that have testimony, and then we are going to hear from the PCA. And after the PCA makes their presentation, I want to make sure that all you folks have a chance. So unless there's a real pressing question for one of the testifiers after Mr. Lewis, I think we want to make sure that we give every one of these testifiers an opportunity, and I don't really want to come back here tonight. Unless we really are made to, then we will come back tonight. But that's not my intention at all. These folks have already been delayed once, and it's snowing outside, and I really don't want to mess up people's schedule too much. So next I have Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lewis, good to see you again. I just wanted to not have too big a discussion. I know we're time sensitive here, but and if I missed it, I apologize. Some of the good things going on over there and some of the research, if you will, that is being done on nutrient reduction using constructed wetlands or those types. So where we can use, you know, kind of the old farm boy analogy, where we're going to use those nutrients and we're going to get something out of it. And using cattails is the one that comes to mind. And so I think there's a lot of creativity going on here. We haven't really gotten into that much, but I wondered if you would speak just briefly to that.
Mr. Lewis.
Representative Purcell, what Representative Purcell is referring to is, and it also answers a little bit Representative Hansen's question, we are trying to use the flood damage reduction impoundments that are getting constructed for flood damage purposes, for water quality purposes as well. We're currently involved with the Bois de Sioux Watershed District on a large project that they constructed called their North Ottawa Project. They basically took 1,900 acres inside of a dike system and constructed treatment cells within those, within that 1,920 acres. We will be working with them on four of those cells, and we received a grant from the Legislative Commission of Minnesota Resources to look at phosphorus removal within that impoundment area and how we can best manage that impoundment for phosphorus reductions as well. Part of that is we are going to be doing cattail harvesting and utilizing cattails to help us capture and remove phosphorus from the system. Those cattails will be put back on cropland as organic matter enhancer and basically nutrient recycling as well.
Thank you. Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. And I don't want to take too long, but I want to understand.
Well, you asked a lot of questions always, Representative Hancock, so I hate to give you any flexibility. You can have all the time you want.
I just want to get a little better idea of our concern here in the Red River Basin is phosphorus. And it's interesting that we're saying 80% of that is from non-point source, at least in your opinion. And what I really want to look at is funds are limited. So where can we best spend our funds? To understand the content, if we look at point source of phosphorus going into the Red River, that's 20%. As I go down the Red River, if we're looking at East Grand and Grand Forks, and we look at Moorhead and Fargo, we look at Wahpeton and Breckenridge, are there any studies as to show what percentage of that point source is coming from the Minnesota side?
Director Lewis.
Chairman McNamara and
Hancock.
Representative Hancock, I don't have the exact split between point sources on the North Dakota side versus the Minnesota. Obviously, the largest contributor is Fargo. It's the largest municipality.
Director
on the
Lewis, what side of the river is that on?
That's on the North Dakota side.
Okay, thank you. Continue, Director Lewis.
their phosphorus discharge is about three times Moorhead. That's located on the other side of the river. Fargo currently does not have a phosphorus standard, and one of the things we've tried to do is work collectively with the group on how is it that we could approach phosphorus reduction. We're trying to establish reduction goals by sub-watershed and then let the sub-watersheds decide what's the most cost-effective way of reaching that. That's the same type of approach that we did with the 20% flow reduction goal. We established a storage criteria by sub-watershed and left the sub-watersheds to decide how to best approach that.
Follow-up, Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. the percentage of phosphorus then coming from these point sources on the Minnesota side, and in terms of reduction, you mentioned that Manitoba would like a 50% reduction. Can you tell me what the standard is now that they are having, and what that 50% reduction would entail?
Director Lewis.
Chairman McNamara and Representative Hancock, I don't have the exact pounds of phosphorus load information off the top of my head. But, you know, basically we'd be looking at a significant reduction. Whether we could ever achieve that 50% or not is going to take some extremely new and innovative approaches.
Would you include the word expensive in there?
You know, I didn't, but what we're hoping to do is, you know, by utilizing the distributed storage sites that are getting built for flood control purposes, with the sites that are needed to meet our 20% flow reduction goal, we feel we can meet our 50% water quality and phosphorus reduction goal by using those facilities in a progressive manner as well. We've seen those reductions initially on some of the testing we've been doing at North Ottawa, and if we can work to make those facilities both flood control as well as water quality, you know, we think we can accomplish two activities with $1.
And Director Lewis, they also could have supplemental benefits of habitat, wildlife corridors, prairie restoration,
the
pollinator habitat. There's all kinds of potential extra benefits involved in that also. Additional follow-up, Representative Hancock.
Just one more. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative or Director Lewis. I'm just trying to get the most value for the dollar here. It seems to me that on our point source contribution from, especially in the Red River itself, from our point sources is a relatively small amount of the phosphorus load that's going into the Red River. If we look at economics of what's happening in North Dakota and what's happening in Minnesota, just from an economic competitive standpoint, it would seem to me that I would encourage the cooperation of North Dakota, Manitoba, Minnesota to develop standards that will ultimately do what we'd like to do, which is reduce the phosphorus in Lake Winnipeg and as it goes through there. I want Minnesota to do its fair share, but I also don't want Minnesota to be spending its dollars unwisely on a project that would affect relatively small input that we're doing. I would say let's spend our money on the non-point sources where we can have the most benefit, and it's just a matter of that. Comments to that regard, I guess it's more of a comment than a question, but I just think we need to really assess the overall picture of the Red River Basin, how we're impacting it, and use our dollars wisely to facilitate that greater picture.
Thank you. Point well made, Representative Hancock. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Lewis. I deeply appreciate your optimism about voluntary efforts to address water quality efforts. I share that. And maybe rather than posing a question, we could spend a lot of time about this with respect to non-point sources. But, Mr. Chair, I would ask that we invite Mr. Lewis back and perhaps others to explore the issue of how can we help people work together in water, using watersheds as our structural basis to enhance the ability for communities and watershed areas to reduce that non-point water source pollution. And I think there's a lot of possibility there, and so I hope in a future hearing we could explore that in some depth.
And to that point, Representative Johnson, we've been in discussion with the Red River Basin folks and a number of folks about a potential wetland replacement project that would potentially fit a lot of these different things, and we will be hearing that bill. To that point, Representative Johnson.
And thank you, Mr. Representative McNamara. The other point I want to make, though, is there's distinct flood control aspects to the Red River Valley. I'm a native of the Red River Valley. I'm well aware of those floods. So I would also hope that we can explore these same things, again, working with watersheds, enhancing voluntary efforts by watershed, but without necessarily that flood control component, because we have those needs in other parts of the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Last question for this testifier, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This should be short. I just was wondering, you were giving that percentages coming, for example, 60% of phosphorus. Excuse me. Can we get those other numbers? If not right now, I'd like to know, like you mentioned, the Rainy River and the Rainy Lake contribution, but you didn't put any numbers on that. And I'm just wondering, do you have those numbers? And if so, could we get them?
Director Lewis, do you know those numbers? Can you give them to us, or is that something you'd like to get back to us with? If you have them off your head, go ahead. Director Lewis.
Chairman McNamara, I actually don't have those numbers, but they are part of the work that's been done for the Lake Winnipeg Initiative. They do have current loads that are coming from each of the major watersheds, and I'd be happy to get that information to you.
Well, if you could work with Representative Fabian, I know he and others are a member of that international group that's aware of that, and if you could get that to the committee, we'll distribute that. Thank you, Representative Clark. Next, thank you, Director Lewis, for presenting today. Next, I'd like to hear from Mr. Quillis. And then I would like it if people could hold their questions of Mr. Quillis. So, Mr. Quillis, if you could give your testimony. And if you do have questions for Mr. Quillis, we'll try and write those down. But I want to allow, there's some folks that want to testify about the other side of this issue, and I want to make sure they get a chance.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Quillis, go ahead.
Very brief. Thank you for the time. I am Tony Quillis, Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And just, if you'll recall last week, Mr. Chairman, we talked about just one standard, and I held up a map. on how just that one water quality standard affected over 673 facilities, ranging from agricultural to industrial, and you've heard from the municipalities and how it affected them. It also affects the business community directly from our NPDES permits, or indirectly where we discharge into someone that has this NPDES permit and has to meet these water quality standards. I think the concern, Mr. Chairman, is not just from one, but all the cumulative effect of all the water quality rules that have been proposed, and I think you've heard that through testimony. So we're worried on its impact on economic development projects in the state. And Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time. Like I said, I am here every day, and would be willing to come back at any time, Mr. Chairman, to answer questions.
Thank you. Did you have a question for Mr. Quillis? Okay. Representative Clark.
This isn't for him, because you said not to ask him a question. This is a question for you. Are we going to hear?
You had a puzzled look on your face, and I always appreciate your input.
I know, but I'm following your orders. So,
you've been here longer than I. You have the flexibility to raise your
That's
hand.
That's okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. I just wanted to ask you, are we going to hear from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities? Because we have a number of documents from them, and if Mr. Quillis is the only one who's they are represented by, then I would have a question. But if we can hear from them, I would appreciate it at some point, just because of some of their statements.
We did hear from them originally, Representative Clark. So if we have time or if you have questions for them, I would encourage them to touch base with Representative Clark. Next, I have Scott Strand, Executive Director for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Director Strand, if you could come down and give us your testimony. And then next, I've got Trevor Russell from Friends of the Mississippi will be next. Welcome, Director Strand. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Strand. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. This year I also serve as the Board Chair for the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, which is an umbrella group of some 70-odd environmental organizations who work in Minnesota. I want to just briefly state the reasons that we do oppose this legislation, and I want to keep it into just a few minutes. We really have five reasons why we think this bill should not be passed. The first one is federal law. You heard a little bit last Thursday about the overlay of federal law, the Clean Water Act. The MPCA operates under a delegation of authority from the EPA. And that delegation, of course, is subject to them meeting federal standards. If they are not enforcing water quality standards that the EPA has approved, or if they are modifying water quality standards without making the scientific case to the EPA, or if they're not adopting rules necessary to meet federal standards, that delegation is in jeopardy. It's not just a theoretical issue. Already the EPA is under a federal court order to take the steps necessary to adopt federal nutrient standards if the states don't adopt their own. So river nutrient standards are coming. At the same time, the EPA made it clear to the PCA back in 2013 in response to our petition that getting numeric nutrient limits on our lakes, rivers, and streams was required in order to stay in compliance with the federal standards. So we really do think that MPCA's limited resources ought to be spent on cleaning up the water, not on trying to fend off the EPA or dealing with litigation under the federal law. Second reason, duplication. Cost-benefit analyses, peer review, are already required. They have already been done for the river nutrient rules. They will be done for the other rules that are on the list. As the League of Women Voters testified last week, the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act carries a whole host of requirements, including cost-benefit analysis. Similarly, the EPA rules and guidance that govern this process are highly prescriptive, and they create another extensive set of hurdles, again, all of which have been met. In your packets, I think there is a list of the different panels of experts from around the country who did review the science here and that were the basis for the EPA approving the standard. So the second reason is duplication. Third reason is I think we need a little skepticism about the costs. We've been hearing lots of numbers being thrown around about how much all of this is going to cost. That's very hard to estimate at this point because we don't have any new effluent limits. This is just a water quality standard. This is what a water quality standard is the goal that we want for the receiving waters. It's not the limits that are going to be imposed on each facility. That's going to take another 3 to 5 years before we impose those limits. And until you know what your limit is, you can't really estimate what your cost is going to be. Most of the wastewater treatment plants in this state, I think, are likely not to end up with stricter effluent limits or phosphorus limits because of these new standards. The reason is that 80% of these plants have already had to make an assessment as to whether or not they meet the lake nutrient standard, which was adopted 10 years ago. So I think it's very unlikely that many of those are going to have to adopt stricter effluent limits, and a lot of the number of plants that are going to have to adopt new limits just because of these new standards, I think, is really relatively limited. For those few plants who will have to get new effluent limits, the chemical and biological processes for getting phosphorus out of the water are pretty well established, and they are not as expensive as people have been suggesting. The Messer group, who was testified on Thursday, commissioned an analysis of the costs a few years ago, and the numbers were rarely in any of the kind of stratospheric heights that we've been hearing about. They went through city by city, recommended the approach that should be taken to reduce phosphorus, put cost estimates on it, and in many cases, including city of Warhead, it was in the low seven figures, not the high eight figures that we keep hearing about. Certainly not the billions of dollars that we've seen on some of the sheets flying around. For those plants that truly do get in a cost bind, and there will be, I suppose, some of those, the MPCA has a whole toolbox full of ways to address those cost problems, variances, extended schedules of compliance. I hesitate to talk about those because we think the MPCA sometimes hands those out a little bit too freely, but they are in the law in order to deal with those situations where immediate compliance with new effluent limits imposes too much of a cost burden. We've heard about trading of water quality credits between point sources. That's a really good program. Just last year, this committee approved legislation dealing with non-point trading, which is something that we do also need to develop because, as I think everybody acknowledges, non-point sources are the largest source of the problem. Number four, the benefits will be substantial. Because of phosphorus, algae blooms and toxic bacteria are becoming a real problem. We all know about the dead zones we've talked about. I think you've heard about the situation with Toledo's drinking water. We've got rivers and streams that are choking. Pictures of some of them that are in the official record are in your packets. Fish kills are not uncommon. It's a serious problem to deal with phosphorus. I'm not going to suggest that these standards by themselves are going to solve the problem. The major problem is non-point sources, and that's what we need to really focus a lot of our efforts on. We acknowledge that the Clean Water Act puts a disproportionate burden on point sources because they're the ones that are regulated. The solution to that, though, is not to abandon the standards. The solution to that is to find ways to reduce that non-point pollution so the burden on the point sources isn't so great. Finally, fifth is just institutional ability. The legislature is not the right place to do the kind of scientific analyses that are required to determine what water quality standards ought to be. There's a reason we have three branches of government. The executive branch has had its run at these. They've applied the science to determine what the standards are going to be. It's now in the courts. These standards have been challenged. They're in the courts. The courts will determine whether they comply with the law. We think that's the process that's in order and is that best reflects the competence of the various branches of government. I don't want to leave the impression that MCA believes that these river standards are exactly right. We think they should have been stronger. We said so throughout the process. But we're not suing, and we're not coming to the legislature for relief because for one paramount reason, and that's that we simply can't wait any longer to get these standards in place. This has been a 20-year process. The suggestion last week that these are somehow a surprise that's not a fair statement. This has been since the mid-1990s that we've been working on this. We've been working on the river nutrient standards for a decade. In the meantime, we've had kids getting sick. We've had homeowners who've seen their property values fall because of algae blooms. We've seen fish kills. We need to do what we can under the law to keep those things from happening. And I submit it's your job to make sure that we accomplish those goals. There is a lot of work to be done. We acknowledge that. We want to work with everybody especially on those non-point efforts. But we do have a situation where we have to let the agency do its job, the job that's required under federal law. We can't abandon science and turn these matters over to a political process any more than we have. So that's why we urge that you oppose these bills.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strand. Next, I'd like to hear from Tressel Russell, Friends of the Mississippi River. If we have time at the end, member, we'll take questions for these testifiers, but I want to make sure MPCA has got a fairly long testimony they'd like to give. Mr. Russell.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Trevor Russell. I'm the Water Program Director with Friends of the Mississippi River. I understand my testimony will be taking time from the PCA, so I will try to be as brief as I can, and I should point out that Scott Strand just stole most of my testimony, so I don't have a whole lot to say that he wasn't going to say. But I do want to just reiterate a few points. The first is that Minnesotans really do value clean water. We care about our lakes, we care about our streams, we care about our drinking water sources. And, you know, excess nutrients create algae blooms that can harm aquatic life, interfere with aquatic recreation, and our lakes and streams can pose risks to humans and pets and can pollute our drinking water resources. Many Minnesotans rely on surface waters that are impaired with phosphorus. We feel that this bill, while well-intentioned, would require some additional duplicative processes on top of the many years of scientific research, public input, peer review that the state already undertakes. I won't reiterate some of the previous testimony on that. It would represent an unnecessary and wasteful use of public funds. We think it would delay work to clean up our surface waters and would invite unwanted federal intervention in our clean water processes. We really have four overarching concerns. The first is sort of political intervention in a science-based water quality standard-setting process. Water quality standards should be established based on the needs of the water resource. They should be based on the ecological function of our surface waters. That's how much pollution a water body can tolerate and still meet its basic health and safety goals. Interjecting political interference in this process, I think, distorts public trust in our public institutions and may yield water quality standards that do not let our water resources meet their intended uses under the Clean Water Act. So I think you're all great people. You're all very bright. You're all very well-intentioned. I think Mr. Johnson represented earlier that we don't know that the legislature is qualified to be the arbiters of complex water quality resource sciences. Oh. And there may be some disagreement or agreement in the room, but I would really caution the legislature from sort of intervening in that standard-setting process. We think that's best left to our resource scientists. The second thing I'll just reiterate, water quality standards are not water resource permits. We set goals and standards for our water resources based on their desired ecological function and outcome. Wastewater treatment effluent permits are effluent performance standards set for permitted entities. These are often facility-specific requirements that deliberately make accommodations for time, site-specific conditions, financial considerations, variances that balance water quality and economic conditions, and a permitted entity's overall share of pollution to surface water. Surface waters in question. While standards do influence permits, the cost implications of permits are handled through an iterative process between the permittee and the agency. If folks are really concerned about those costs, I think we can work with state agencies and permitted entities to find that optimal balance rather than creating a whole new water quality standards process for the entire state if really the question here is a few wastewater treatment plants in the Red River Basin. If we're concerned about that, let's focus on that. But recreating or restructuring our entire statewide water quality standards process and suspending already approved water quality standards doesn't seem like the optimal way to really get at the issue in question. The PFA has addressed some of the cost concerns that came up. I just do want to point out that their 2015 intended use plan states that the PFA currently estimates the average clean water revolving fund lending capacity to be approximately $100 million per year in perpetuity. And then lastly, we've brought up some of the fairness issues. Keep in mind, Canada has instituted nutrient removal criteria for its wastewater treatment facilities. The Winnipeg plants are already at 1 milligram per liter. North Dakota has already committed to doing this as well. Minnesota has long been a leader in water quality standards. We don't think that we should let other states prevent us from meeting our water quality goals because they're not quite as far along as we are. So in summary, I know we're short on time, Mr. Chair. I'll just say Minnesotans really do value our clean water. We have strong standards, science-based standards that have been peer-reviewed. Cost estimates are in place. We've followed the Administrative Procedures Act. They've been reviewed by judges. They've been reviewed by the EPA. They've been reviewed by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency Citizens Board. And we don't feel like that is a process that's broken. If we're concerned about wastewater treatment plant effluent permits, let's work with those facilities but not undermine the scientific credibility of our standard-setting process. With that, Mr. Chair, I will step aside and allow the PCA to come down if there are no questions.
Well, Mr. Russell, I have one more testifier. Mr. Hodge. Ottinger, if you want to come forward. Next, you're not going to testify? We should hear from you. Come on now. You're on the list. You deserve to at least say hello. Next, I'd like to hear from former Senator John Hottinger on behalf of Sierra Club North Star Chapter. Yeah. Welcome, Senator. If you could identify yourself for the record, who you represent.
My name's John Hottinger, and you can hardly hear me, which is one of the reasons I'm going to just say hello. In addition, the last two testifiers did a great job, and I want to hear from the MPCA. I was going to talk about the administrative process that we've used for decades, as other states have, to make these scientific decisions, but I'm already running out of voice. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you, Senator, for coming down. Appreciate it. MPCA, if you want to come forward, I think we'll be okay. We'll have you walk through your entire testimony, and then we may have to just have you reply to the questions electronically or in writing if we don't have time. We have two small bills, members, and I want to really be wrapped up by a quarter to 10-2 at the very latest. I think we can walk through both bills in just a matter of 5 minutes each. They're both for possible inclusion in a bill later on. Welcome back, Commissioner Flood. If you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Flood. I'm an Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And with me is Katrina Kessler, who is the manager in charge of the section that develops both water quality standards and effluent limitations that appear in permits. And we really appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Files 616 and 617. These two bills are of serious concern to the Pollution Control Agency because they would slow down water permitting. They're duplicative of existing processes, and they would increase costs for both permittees and for taxpayers. These bills contain requirements for legislative approval of water quality standards, require an analysis of costs and impacts versus the original cost-benefit analysis. They require independent peer review and suspend recently approved water quality standards for phosphorus. At their core, water quality standards are about science, and science tells us how many molecules of phosphorus will generate too much algae slime, and that slime can be toxic to fish, water insects, and in some cases can kill dogs, for example, that come in contact with it, as well as endanger our drinking water, like last summer's trouble with the city of Toledo's drinking water that was contaminated from algae that was blooming in Lake Erie. At the hearing on February 26 last week, testimony provided from a variety of different groups overwhelmingly expressed concerns not about the science, but about the costs to implement these new standards, and as well as upcoming standards, and asked that cumulative impacts of costs on all water quality standards be looked at. You also heard similar cost concerns and testimonies on House File 1000 regarding the implementation of a new standard for the protection of wild rice. There really were no arguments about how many molecules of phosphorus is too much. I want to make you aware also that Commissioner Stein, our senior leadership at PCA, and I have met with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, as well as MESRB, where they stated that they were predominantly concerned about costs, but feel as though if they do not fight the development and adoption of water quality standards, they will have no alternative when it comes to implementation, which is not the case. Regarding the cost issue, the PCA is also very concerned about the potential cost to implement not only these recent phosphorus standards, but also standards that will be coming in the next several years that address pollutants such as chloride, nitrate, and sulfate, among other potential new standards. So if the predominant concern is about cost, then I submit to you that we should focus on the implementation cost conversation rather than things that don't address the cost issue. Some of you may know that municipal water infrastructure was highly subsidized at the beginning of the Clean Water Act when it was passed in 1972. Federal grants paid for 75% of the cost of wastewater infrastructure. The state provided grants for 15%, and locals had to cover only the remaining 10%. Federal grants were phased out during the Reagan and Bush administrations, as we have now moved toward today's revolving loan program. The shift to more local funding is a real concern, and not just for city administrators, but for all of us. We recognize that concern, and we want to clearly state that it is one that MPCA shares. We understand why communities are concerned. With that said, I know that we're here to provide testimony on House File 616 and 617 and the A3 amendment. And before I get to the details of our concerns with these two bills, Mr. Chair, I'd like to speak for a moment on the difference between standards and permits. And in your package last week, we provided this graphic in your package. So I would like to draw your attention to that and also for you to look at item one, which talks about water quality standards. Under the Clean Water Act, states are required to identify what citizens value about our water resources, whether that's swimming or fishing or aquatic recreation. Then we use these best available science to describe the conditions that support those values. These goal-setting efforts are how water quality standards are developed. Standards are the numeric goals that we seek to achieve in order to have fishable, swimmable, and drinkable water. How many molecules of phosphorus, which will result in green algae slime, or how much low dissolved oxygen actually suffocate fish? If a state fails to adopt a standard needed to protect water quality, the EPA can exert its authority to adopt a standard on the state's behalf. This has already happened recently in Florida, Arkansas, and Missouri, with lots of dollars spent on lawyers and going to court. Now I want to direct your attention here on this same graphic to the blue arrow on the right side of the handout, which is about permitting. A permit is not the same thing as a water quality standard. The permitting process starts with the evaluation of facility-specific information and factors such as flow, the discharge quality, the timing of the discharge that determine what, if any, limits are required to protect the water quality standards in the receiving water. Once the discharge requirements are identified to protect the receiving water, then the realities of cost, the availability of technology, and planning timelines come into play. As mentioned previously, this involves a lot of back and forth conversations between the Pollution Control Agency and the permittees. Permittees have multiple opportunities to read and give input on a permit at this point before that permit is even posted to receive the public's comment on that document. In working on permits, the Pollution Control Agency can use a number of tools to provide flexibility or assistance to permittees. In this way, we ensure that permit requirements do not result in widespread economic impacts. These tools are identified in item two here on the handout. So flexible timelines and extended schedules allow communities time to evaluate technology, to design the technology that might be needed to meet a limitation, and to secure funding options. It's not unusual for these schedules to take upwards of 10 years, as we've seen in examples such as the Alexandria Lake Area Sanitary District, the cities of Wells, Easton, Minnesota Lake, and Marshall. We also have a tool that's known as variances from permit discharge limits. This is an option if implementation of the limit would result in widespread economic burden or if necessary technology to reach those limitations is out of reach. As mentioned by Mr. Freeman, we work closely with Mr. Freeman from the Public Facilities Authority where they have grants and loans. As he mentioned, those point source implementation matching grants of up to 50% and $3 million to help meet discharge limits to protect water quality. Since 2007, 36 communities have received grants totaling $48 million from the Public Facilities Authority to meet phosphorus limits. And there's a handout that he provided that explains that in further detail. Our two primary concerns with House File 616 are that they would slow down the permitting process. As Ms. Weifel testified on Thursday, House File 616 would slow permitting process by avoiding current standards and delay future revisions of those standards. House File 616 would delay permit actions that are needed to address nutrients and other water quality concerns. delays our update to our standards, which in turn delay our ability to issue permits in a timely way to meet our permit timeliness goals that are established in statute. By creating these delays, this bill would invite the EPA and others to object to our permits or compel action in other time-consuming and costly ways. Our second concern is that cost-benefit analyses or the analysis of cost and impact in the A3 amendment required by House File 616 will impose new costs for the PCA, for permittees, and for Minnesota taxpayers. By changing this requirement to cost from a cost-benefit analysis to evaluation and analysis of costs and impacts, it makes it even closer to the work that we already do in preparation of the statement of need and reasonableness that accompanies any pollution control agency rulemaking, so it is even more duplicative. Costs are identified already at a high level in our statement of need and reasonableness. I also want to mention to you in 1998, the legislature asked the Pollution Control Agency to study the cost of doing a cost-benefit analysis for water permitting. A stakeholder group, some members of which are in the room today, directed that study. Mr. Lloyd Grooms was also chaired that committee. The report concluded that at that time it would cost $3.4 million to $4.5 million and take 4 years just to establish the framework that we would use to do a cost-benefit analysis. In 2014 dollars, that's between $5 and $6.4 million just to develop framework. It does not include the cost of basing each cost-benefit analysis on 15 communities. It does not include the cost of applying each of the required items to that framework. You also took testimony last Thursday from representatives from the cities of Mankato and Breckenridge. Given that both these communities have already done significant phosphorus reduction because of another phosphorus rule that was adopted in 2008 for the protection of lakes and reservoirs, I want to clearly state that these facilities would not have to upgrade their facilities to meet the new river phosphorus standard that was just recently adopted. Now I want to send you back to the graphic here on the left side of the graphic, where, and I'll explain what this legend is here at the bottom. You'll see on the map, I don't represent if you have that or not, but the facilities located by blue dots are treatment plants with downstream lakes. A lot of those already have phosphorus requirements and will likely not face additional requirements because of the recently adopted phosphorus rule. The orange dots represent wastewater treatment plants which may need new phosphorus discharge limits to protect rivers. Most of those facilities don't currently have effluent limitations that address phosphorus. The purple dots along the Red River of the North are wastewater treatment plants which need phosphorus reductions to help protect Great Winnipeg. And the small gray dots are small facilities that will need no limits due to lake or river water quality standards at this particular time. So a lot of the facilities, small facilities, are already addressed.
Ms. Flood, how much more time do you have? I don't want to cut you off.
Probably 10 minutes at the most.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Regarding House File 6617, this bill would also slow down permitting, and our concern is that it would also add additional costs on permittees. The assertion that MPCA has not conducted independent peer review is simply unfounded. 617 would require independent peer reviews be done on proposed water quality standards or for studies, analyses, and scientific work or guidance that is used by the agency to make regulatory decisions. This has a huge potential to impact the very permittees that the bill is aiming to protect. Our staff estimate that there are hundreds of work products generated each year that the agency uses to make regulatory decisions. Of the examples of these studies and analyses that the MPCA uses to make such regulatory decisions run the gamut in scope and scale. These can include anything from information used by the Pollution Control Agency to grant simple permits such as sewer extension permits, would apply to municipal stormwater pollution prevention plans, as well as environmental assessment worksheets and environmental impact statements. This information we use to make regulatory decisions. However, the peer review would needed to be developed by project proposers like municipalities and industries, not by the Pollution Control Agency. That information would need to be submitted as a part of their permit applications to us. Therefore, we're concerned that House File 617 would add significant additional cost burdens to cities and businesses because of the fact that they would need to do that independent peer review on the information that they develop and submit to us with their permit information. Requiring that information permittees submit to inform the MPCA permit decisions must be peer-reviewed and undergo an additional public comment period before an environmental review document or permit is public noticed will slow down permitting considerably. Permittees would have to cover that cost of peer review for the information they submit. In addition, costs go up for permittees due to delays, as mentioned above, or by EPA's imposition of less flexible approaches to permit requirements than those approaches and tools that are employed by the PCA.
I get your message, and it's a very valuable one, but I think there's a few people that would like to make comment. I'm going to just ask you to wrap it up in another minute or two, and I don't know if Ms. Kessler's got some comments, because I can see something here, a possible solution. So I just want to give you just a couple minutes to wrap it up if you have a couple points.
Very well, Mr. Chair. We also wanted to mention that we're very concerned about costs of permitting and permit requirements, and we work very closely with permittees to develop cost-effective approaches. As you heard last week, the City of Mankato's wastewater discharge they've done incredible work to reduce the amount of phosphorus that's in their discharge, and we congratulate them on that great success. As I mentioned earlier, they would not have to do additional work and reduce phosphorus under the existing river eutrophication standard. In those instances where PCA has worked with permittees to ensure water quality protection did not compromise the local economy, and we're committed to taking the same approach with communities around the state as well as in the development of the Lake Winnipeg nutrient reduction strategy that's being worked on by the Red River Basin of the North as well as North Dakota and Manitoba. And we're happy to stand for any questions that you may have at this time. Thank you.
Commissioner Flood, thank you for coming forward, and thank you for cutting it short and cutting it short again after I asked you to cut it short again. Commissioner Flood, this is a serious issue. It's a bill that's got wide bipartisan support. It's going to pass the House. And I don't want to wait until we're in conference committee in May to deal with this issue. We've heard testimony on both sides of the issue about the seriousness, and you've talked about how it's important we do a cost-benefit analysis and not just a cost of what it is. I don't want to get hung up in that. I want MPCA to get serious about this and work with folks. Folks on both sides of the issue have raised legitimate concerns. There's a pending lawsuit. I want the pending lawsuit to go in the back for now. And I want you folks to try and work on it. I get real nervous when we legislatively get in the middle of a lawsuit. So short of us putting you in a position that you can't be in, I want you to work with the interested parties. You're the folks. I'm encouraged by all the folks on the advocate side talking about how they want science-based decisions by MPCA. Well, they hear a bill, I think, next week about that exact thing. And so I'm looking forward to them coming forward and testifying how we should have science-based decisions and not necessarily folks that aren't necessarily scientists making decisions about MPCA issues. So it'll be interesting to see if they like it both ways when it comes to that matter. That's a different issue. But Commissioner Flood, if you could go back to Commissioner Stein and tell him that we are serious. This bill is going to pass. It's going to be a House position, and there's a solution here. And you folks need to come together. I'd rather have you as scientists working with folks on both sides of the issue figure it out. But it's not fair that we say, oh, yeah, Breckenridge, you've taken care of it. Sorry, Wahpeton's got all the stuff going on. They're fixing their streets up, and they're planting trees and building pretty signs and all that. And poor Breckenridge's people are paying their water bills. And so that's the challenge I have. I want to let a few people ask questions. I've got Representative Cornish for a short comment. Representative Hornstein, I think your question may be for MCEA, and then it is. Okay, what I want to do is I'm going to take Cornish as a comment, Houseman as a comment, and then Hornstein's going to ask a question of MCEA, and then the bills are going to get laid over. Or is there anybody else has a comment? Representative Hansen will have a comment. Anybody else want to make a comment? Representative Clark? Purcell, you want to make a comment?
Sure.
Okay, good enough. There we're at. Okay, let's rock and roll. We've got Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, my comment won't be quite as gentle as yours, but it'll be respectful. I was offended by the arrogance of the bureaucrats that testified here today in saying that we weren't qualified to make decisions. You wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for the legislature or your funding, your pensions, or your planning or operations. We gave you rulemaking authority, of which many of us regret. And the reason you're here today and we have some of these bills is because of this arrogance. And instead of standing between the EPA and the farmer and the businessman and the miner and the power companies, it seems like you're doing is worshiping the shrine of the EPA and saying there's nothing we can do. And it's just offensive. And I think the legislature is highly qualified, and we're here to stand up for the citizen, too. That my biggest complaint right now is state agencies and overregulation. And the question I had is of our researchers, if they could research what states are actually fighting the EPA, what are the penalties, if you've just asked them to take a hike and go our own way, or if there's any way to modify this instead of just worshiping the EPA shrine and saying there's nothing we can do and throwing our hands in the air, testifier after testifier, say it's federal guidelines, there's nothing we can do. So that's it.
So we'll work with our House research to get that information. I'm going to go, Representative Hornstein, I'll save yours because I think it was for MCEA. Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To your comments, I guess, because as I listen to everybody, and I even listen to your motivation for passing a bill on the House floor is, it does seem to me that idea, implementation costs are the issue. And even when I listen to the chamber, it seems to me that's at the root of it. What I heard both the PCA and PFA say this morning is there are vast numbers of ways in which they work with cities to help with the implementation cost. I think Mr. Freeman mentioned at least five. There were five or six entities that already provide this kind of resource help. The one thing I'm curious about is the two statewide organizations that have an interest in this, the League of Cities and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. It would be helpful to know, do they perhaps help small cities apply for PFA grants? I know in the case of when we had the housing grants, a state conference of the public housing folks had a session just for small cities, and they had the resource people right in the room to help those small cities that perhaps didn't have the staff. So if we are focusing all of this energy and all of this expectation on the wrong thing, and if we ought to be spending all of our time talking about implementation costs, I even heard that suggested in your hopes for what would be accomplished if this bill passed on the floor.
Thank you, Representative Houseman. And Mr. Freeman, I would ask you if you could get back to us with the information on those groups and who is able to help the small cities and such. And I see those folks that represent those interests are here, and they're listening and nodding their head. I've got a couple more that I want you to make your comments. If you have questions, we're going to have the questions get back to us electronically so they can get answered. But I do want to let members make their comments, and we are going to be wrapped up before 10-2, so we have about 4 minutes left, and I have four people to make comments, so that's going to give you about a minute each. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a specific question for PCA, and if that's possible, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Hansen.
Ms. Flood, you talked about science. Is there some new science that's come out about drinking water being poisoned with blue-green algae that leads to Parkinson's or Alzheimer's? Has the agency looked at human impact? Because we've had discussions about dogs dying, but when you look at setting standards, are you bringing in science continues to be developed and published. Have you incorporated any work on impacts to human beings from toxic blue-green algae?
Ms. Kessler, you want to give that a short answer, or else you can reply back to us. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman and members. I'm Katrina Kessler. As Rebecca said, or Ms. Flood said, I'm the manager of the water assessment section, and yes, there is research that's ongoing to that point, and EPA is developing a national criteria for that type of bacteria that is found in blue-green algae to protect human health and wildlife, and Minnesota and the MPCA are following that research.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I feel I need to respond to Representative Cornish, because it, you know, as we're here for year after year, we just see the same old cliches and talking points that keep coming forward. Ms. Flood, I want to thank you and your staff for the work you do on behalf of the people of Minnesota. It's common to bash the EPA. It's common to bash public employees. Mr. Chair, you made an effort of trying to hold out an olive branch there to work together, but you know, then we get the same old stuff. I wish the cameras that are watching us could pan the audiences that are here for all these hearings. Now, there are some agency people here, and there are occasionally a few people, the public, but most of the people that are in the audience are paid to be here. They're paid to be here to have an impact on the results. That's why these bills want it to come back to the legislature. And Ms. Flood, did both under Governor Pawlenty and Governor Dayton, have we vetoed similar legislation of legislative review of rules?
Ms. Flood, this is the last question, then we're moving on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe it is the case that Governor Pawlenty vetoed a bill, a piece of legislation attempting to have legislative approval of standards.
Thank you.
And Governor Dayton?
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this is kind of the stage for this was set a little bit by the last question in terms of some of the human health issues that are hopefully part of the cost-benefit analysis. So one of the things I've thought in listening to this testimony, maybe this is a question for the author as well, we do have to be concerned about human health impacts and in the cost-benefit analysis. And so I'm wondering if you're thinking or are willing to have this bill go before the health committee so we might look at some of these issues, because that is an extremely important part of the cost-benefit analysis, in my opinion. And I think it hasn't been talked about very much, so somebody needs to really talk about it more.
Representative Clark, we will check with those committees to see if they want to hear this bill, but I would say that's in the jurisdiction of this committee, where I would think, but that I will let those committee chair people decide if they want to hear the bill or not. Does that answer your question, Representative Clark?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in a way, but maybe it's something that we could continue to have some dialogue on.
We will.
I know that you care about contaminants in the waters of our Minnesotans, things that have come up in your own district and in my district all over, and I just I don't know that we're equipped to necessarily fully explore those.
Thank you. Representative Purcell, last comment, and then we're going to have Representative Hornstein ask his question, and the MCEA will need to hear his question and reply to us electronically. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I I just wanted to say it. Representative Cornish, you kind of stole my thunder a little bit. You're offended. I'm offended too, but not for the same reason. MPCA doesn't bother me, although we don't get along on everything. But I'm offended. You look at this map, and most of the sewer treatment plants in Minnesota did the right thing. We did the right thing in Bemidji 30 years ago. 30 years ago. And instituted phosphorus reduction so we could save Lake Bemidji, Big Wolf Lake, Anjuja, Cass Lake, Winnebagoches, on down the Mississippi River, goes through all of them, so we could send you all down here cleaner water. Cleaner water. And now, a few sewer treatment plants, a few cities want to say, oh, no, not me. We don't want to do this. Well, bull hockey. That ain't right. That ain't fair. That ain't the way we do things in Minnesota. So I just want to say I support what you're trying to do, MPCA, and let's do the right thing here and support standards the way they're supposed to be developed. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Representative Hornstein, you had a question for MCEA, I believe it was.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we heard a lot previously about the idea of having voluntary compliance, that we wouldn't have necessarily standards, but we would ask these municipalities and others to cooperate voluntarily. And I guess I would ask MCA if they know of whether that's actually worked anywhere. To me, if someone's willing to do something voluntarily, then what's wrong with complying with the standard, if you're doing it anyway? So I guess either Mr. Strand or maybe the PCA could give me any examples where this has actually worked, since we heard that as a possible solution.
Thank you. MPCA will work with MCEA to reply to Representative Hornstein's question. Representative Fabian renews his motion that House File 616 and 617 be laid over. Representative Hackforth, House File 572. Representative Hackforth, you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'd move House File 572 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Representative Hackforth, if you could explain your bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer a short amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like. On line 1.8, between the word all and fees, insert the word application.
Ms. Taylor, can you read the amendment back as Representative Hackbart's proposed?
Mr. Chair, members, it'd be on House File 572, line 1.8, after all, insert application. So it would read from all application fees.
Any discussion of the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment's adopted. Representative Hackbart, the bill's now in the shape you'd like. I think your first testifier is Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, I understand you and the DNR have an agreement. You just want to acknowledge that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name's Joel Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. We have worked with the DNR to get the bill in a shape that's acceptable to them.
Thank you. DNR, do you want to testify to that, or do you want to acknowledge that on the tape? Ms. Lewis, she gave a thumbs up. Ms. Lewis acknowledges. Representative Hackbart, do you want to renew your motion?
I'd renew my motion, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have House File 1008, Representative Dill's bill. Representative Dill, if you want to come forward. Representative Dill, do you have any testifiers, or you're just going to explain your bill yourself?
No.
Representative Dill.
I'd like to move the bill for inclusion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dill.
It's only one change, line 1.13 in the existing language and statute from 8% to 4%. This is purely a reflection of what market conditions are for interest rates. It reflects rates that are charged by other agencies for a variety of different things, whether it be overdue fines, things of that nature. This would go to put a bit more money back into the loggers' pocket so that they could use to update their equipment, pay their employees, and a variety of other things. This year, in 2014, the amount of money and interest collected by the department is $130,000 on these timber extension sales, $130,000 in interest. That is, interestingly, three times more money than they collected in 2013, and that is because the commissioner did not issue any extensions during the 2014 timbering season. This is brought to me by the logging community. It's one of several things that we're looking with and working with the department on trying to streamline or to make better effectuate the ability for loggers to stay in business and to yet keep the DNR's sales continuing on into the future. So with that, I stand for questions, and I think that Mr. Schmidt is here from the DNR. Maybe he wants to comment on the bill. He talked to me earlier, said they're neutral on it.
Representative Dill, I think you've got a really good bill here. The one thing I would add is, I know we're laying it over for possible inclusion. I mean, 8% is, I'm sorry, it's absurd today for these poor loggers that are paying an 8% rate. That's not realistic with anything going on in the environment today in these rates of low, low single-digit rates. The one thing I would wonder about is if we should tie it to something that would keep it low but put maybe a maximum cap on it. So if we move this forward, I'd like to continue to work on this, because this is not fair that these folks that are having a tough time working today. So, Representative Dill, I think you got a good bill. I think your number's in the ballpark, but I'm actually concerned maybe that we put some kind of a cap on it so it doesn't go too high, which you do have, but maybe we would allow it to even operate at a low rate. I think that it should have. It truthfully encourages the DNR to capture this 8% money. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dill, I know last year we had some discussion about SFIA and impacts for the logging industry on that. And just wondering, in addition to this interest, the bill you have in front of us, is there some work being done to try to look at how some of the existing programs are being done to impact the loggers?
Representative Dill.
Yes, sir. Representative Hansen. Well, SFIA really affects the landowner, not the loggers. So we're really talking about two separate issues in totality. Yes, the answer is I authored a bill. It'll be in the hopper on today's business, I believe, to adopt most of, if not all, of the regulations or recommendations of the auditor's office on the SFIA program, as well as a couple of extra tweaks that I want to add in there to even make it tighter. It has nothing to do with this, Mr. Chairman. The Fed fund rate this morning was about 0.225. of 1%, and a home loan now on a 30-year mortgage is about 3.51 with no points and a $900 origination fee through Wells Fargo, and this is not a reasonable number at this point. I would be very willing to tie it to the Fed funds rate with a minimum and a maximum.
Thank
so I would be glad to do that as we work forward on this bill. Thank you.
Well, if you work with the department, I think we need to get it. We can't have it. There's one more question, Representative Dill. Representative Hausman, last question.
Well, that sort of clarified it.
Okay.
I wanted to just inquire because it says 8% may be charged, which tells me that's not what they're necessarily doing. It's an upper limit. But your flexibility, I think, would have to be more helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, they are charging 8%, and that is the amount, and that's just not a reasonable number, as we've discussed. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to renew my motion to lay the bill over.
Thank you, Representative Dill. I was going to, if we were ready, just quickly touch on folks our schedule for the next 2 days. Tomorrow we have House File 690 of Fabianville deals with Section 404 permitting. We have House File 1326, a bill I'm carrying that deals with, that looks like that's the MPCA's policy bill. And then there's a bill that DNR is bringing forward in reaction to the OLA report on conservation easement stewardship. That's Wednesday. On Thursday, we are having AIS Day, for lack of a better term. It will include a couple different Representative Drazkowski bills. One is the bill that Representative Hackbarth has already heard. The other one is deals with the county program that will be sent on to the tax committee where that discussion will take place. And then the Uglem bill, which you're working with the DNR bill, and I believe at some point there'll probably be an amendment posted on that bill. The DNR is nodding to get it more in the shape the agency would like, and somewhere between all those bills will be our long-term solution that this committee probably will pass out. Any additional questions from anyone? Members, we're adjourned. Thank you.